Okay, this is the last session this afternoon. Okay. So, if everybody can take a seat, we'll get going. The first speaker in the last session here is Robert Anderson, and he'll talk about Indian water rights, litigation and settlements.
Thank you, Ann, and everyone. It's a real honor to be over here, and I see many friends in the audience, and it's nice to get out of the law school. So, 15 minutes, and off to the races we go. So, Indian water rights, litigation and settlements. Professor Rogers talked a little bit a little earlier this afternoon about how law can quickly change, and Indian water rights have been an incredibly important factor in the way water is used in the West, and especially recent years involving a settlement of Indian water rights in combination with hopefully resolution of some other issues involving Endangered Species Act issues and whatnot. But let me run through the history of Indian water rights and talk a little bit about changes that we might see in the Pacific Northwest based on these Indian Reserve water rights, which are based on federal law and pursuant to the Constitution. They are supreme over state law water rights that might be established after Indian Reserve rights are set aside. State law provides for first in time, first in right, the prior appropriation doctrine, all geared toward getting water out of rivers and putting it to so-called beneficial uses, either on land that's adjacent to stream or even outside of the basin. And you all know the many problems that's caused environmentally with respect to fisheries habitat and whatnot. First in time is first in right. Beneficial uses until very recently not recognized as being any in-stream uses at all. Recreation, fisheries purposes, generally not considered beneficial uses until the advent of the 70s and 80s and some of the environmental legislation. Water rights can be traded, transferred, marketed, which they frequently are outside of the basins pursuant to state law. The beauty of Indian water rights is that they're federally protected water rights. Congress has exclusive power to regulate commerce with Indian tribes. States are generally out of the picture with respect to regulatory jurisdiction over tribes, their members, and their properties. Indian tribes have treaties, which are the supreme law of the land. Treaty making ended in 1871, but the existing treaties, including all of the Stevens treaties that served as the foundation for the Bolt decision and Indian fishing rights, remain in effect. Their property rights, the rights that are protected by the Fifth Amendment to the Constitution. And in the fishing rights context, we see that you have the right to up to 50% of the fisheries. Professor Rogers talked about the right to have passage through culverts underneath state highways. Similarly, you need water to support these treaty fisheries. And that's the big gun that the tribes have sort of behind their back, ready to wield here in federal court, I think, sometime soon. The state law must bow to federal law under the Supremacy Clause. Treaties are generally construed in favor of tribes. They're reservations of rights that the tribes possessed as original owners of the land and as sovereign governments that preexisted the establishment of the United States. If you run into an ambiguous clause, like in common with, you interpret the term as the Indians would have understood it. Judge Bolt said that meant the tribes retained up to half of the harvestable fish passing by their usual and accustomed places. In addition, additional rights should be implied to give meaning to the treaty. Namely, if you've got a right to fish, you got to have a right to water, I think. I'm no scientist, though. United States versus Winans is the best and first example of the Supreme Court's recognition of these principles. The Winans brothers were private property owners adjacent to the Columbia River. They saw some Indians crossing their property to go to a fishing site. They tried to block their access. The Supreme Court said, no, the Indians retained, they reserved a fishing right, therefore they reserved an easement to cross your private property, even though the title you received from the United States said nothing about an easement in the Indian tribe and its members. Winters versus United States expanded Winans, recognized that when a reservation of land is set aside for a tribe, it carries with it a reservation of water for irrigation purposes. In that case, more about that. Arizona versus California in 1963, another U.S. Supreme Court case that further cemented these Indian water rights pertaining to reservations set aside by treaty, executive order, which we have several in Washington, or by statute. The Winters case arose on the Fort Belknap Reservation, the 1888 reservation. You see that you see right here, the typical pattern of U.S. Encroachment on tribal lands leads to smaller and smaller reservations, so that by 1888, this is all that's left. Non-Indians begin using water after 1888, but before the tribe starts using water. And the normal rule in the West would be, while the non-Indians started to use the water first, that means they get to continue to use it. The Indians get whatever is left over, which wasn't enough. And the Supreme Court in the Winters case said, no, when that reservation was set aside, it carried with it an implied reservation of water. As of 1888, the non-Indians, even though they started using water first, have to step aside and permit the tribes to irrigate their lands first. The non-Indians get what is left over. After Winters, we have all these, we have open-ended decrees, I call them. So the court in Winters declared that the Fort Belknap tribes had water rights. How much, we still don't know today. They've been working on it for 100 years. Still no settlement. I saw their lawyer last month. He's hopeful. Allotment water rights just further complicate the matter. As reservations were broken up in the late 19th and early 20th centuries, land was divided up, tribal lands given to individual Indians. They have water rights. They sometimes have tension with the tribes over the extent of their rights versus the tribes. Tribes are governments. Individual Indians are constituents. There's a potential for conflict. What the United States did after this great victory in 1908 in the Winters case was spend all their money building reclamation projects and Army Corps of Engineers projects. So instead of recognizing and protecting Indian rights, they moved the water out for non-Indian development. One estimate is that there were 360 Bureau of Reclamation projects finished since 1902 and one Indian irrigation project. And that Indian irrigation project primarily serves non-Indians. That's why it got finished. Now, the other nasty thing that Congress did, besides spending all of its resources on non-Indian development, was it passed a law called the McCarran Amendment, which gave state courts the authority to adjudicate these federally protected Indian rights. And the U.S. Supreme Court, in a series of cases in the late 1970s and 80s, upheld these assertions of jurisdiction by states over federal and Indian reserved water rights. And the Supreme Court went so far as to say that even if the tribe can't be made a party because it's a sovereign and has sovereign immunity, the tribe's rights can be taken before the court because the United States holds those rights in trust, and the U.S. can be brought into state court. So you see all of these little state court adjudications. They're not so little. The Snake River adjudication had 110,000 parties and went on for 20 years, but the states have the wherewithal to get the U.S. into their hometown court. And along with that, many biases that infect judgment calls that these courts make about the scope and extent of Indian water rights. Arizona versus California, again, this brought an end to the open-ended decree era. The court said enough water is reserved to meet present and future needs of the Indian reservation, and we're not going to calculate that for agricultural reservations based on the number of Indians. We're going to look at something called PIA, which is a experts, here's the Colorado River and the reservations involved. The PIA is a an exercise overseen by lawyers with a team of economists, civil engineers, agronomists, and tribal members who construct hypothetical irrigation projects to show whether or not it's economically feasible to irrigate a particular piece of land. If you can prove that to the judge, you get the water. It's amazing. I would never accuse an expert or a scientist of bias or of cooking the books, but it's amazing how the economists can differ on the appropriate discount rate, depending on whether they work for the state or for the tribe in the United States. So it's an incredibly expensive exercise, but it gets you to an amount of water that the tribe would be entitled to for irrigation purposes. Tribal water right claims are typically made for ag, that's the PIA. For fisheries purposes, that's the big issue. That's the big ticket item in the Northwest. The Washington Supreme Court has recognized that tribes have reserved water rights to protect their treaty rights. The Ninth Circuit has done so in litigation involving the Klamath Reservation in the Adair case, and a couple of district courts have done the same in eastern Washington and again on the Colville Reservation, recognition by the Ninth Circuit of water rights for fisheries purposes. The problem is how much water. How much water do you need to support a viable fishery, a fishery that can provide a tribe with a moderate standard of living, according to the U.S. Supreme Court? We don't know, but it's more than is in the stream now. So these are the cases here that that you can look at that recognize this in-stream flow protection. Litigation, it's always risky. We've got these good cases, the last good one in 1963 from the Supreme Court, Wyoming versus United States, a big PIA case that went to the court in 1989. Justice O'Connor wrote an opinion. We found out the case ended up being decided on a 4-4 basis, so there was no opinion. David Getchis from the University of Colorado went and looked at some papers of Justice Marshall, who was on the court, and discovered that Justice O'Connor had written and supplied the fifth vote for a majority opinion that would have been disaster for Indian tribes and their water rights. But at the last minute, she had to recuse herself because she discovered that she owned a ranch with her brother that was involved in Indian water rights litigation. So let's thank goodness for private property ownership in the Supreme Court. So what's the Supreme Court going to do? We don't know. Our Western justices are gone, replaced by John Roberts and Alito. What are their views? We don't know. Arizona Supreme Court has mucked around in the area, something for better, something for worse. We just don't know how the litigation will come out. Will the Supreme Court recognize reserved water rights for in-stream flows? The Ninth Circuit has. They get reversed a lot. So with all of this uncertainty, we've had a lot of promotion of settlements. There have been 22 since 1978. There's 27 tribes right now in various stages of settlement negotiations, including some here in Washington. These Indian water settlements are consistent in having a lot of federal dollars being pumped into an area to make up for past inequities to the tribe, to provide drinking water facilities for tribal members, to encourage economic development. They tend to defer to state water law. There's a lot of benefits for non-Indians. They tend not to lose any water. In the Snake River case, though, we see that the tribe, although it had lost its in-stream flow case in the trial court, the case was on appeal, Congress provided water for in-stream flows, recognizing tribal rights, also provided in the neighborhood of $126 million for habitat restoration in the Salmon and Clearwater basins as part of an ESA settlement that was wrapped into and folded into the Indian water rights settlement. And I think that's the wave of the future. And the federal government set aside its veil of fiscal responsibility and said, look, we're going to settle this water case. It's going to take money. We created the problems. We're going to provide money for water projects to improve fisheries and to improve habitat, to improve forestry practices in the Snake and Salmon Clearwater reservations, and we're going to allow the tribes to do the majority of the work and oversee it. They know best. They've got fisheries biology staffs, and after all, the reason we're at the table is because of the tribal water rights. So, you know, like the culvert case, I think it's only a matter of time before we get another piece of major federal court litigation involving in-stream flows, perhaps on behalf of some of, or all of the U.S. v. Washington tribes. It has to be on a drainage-specific basis, so they're very expensive pieces of litigation, but I can assure you that the tribes have a very strong legal basis for their in-stream flow rights, and they're in a powerful negotiating position should we get a declaration in favor of those rights, then we can see what can be done to improve the situation. And I'll stop now. Any questions? Those are the some reference books you can look at. So any questions? Covered everything. My students said they were going to ask me questions today. I usually ask the questions. All right. Oh, great.
It was on NPR yesterday about this issue at Snowball in Arizona about the use of, or the proposed use of
effluent.
Waste.
Yep.
For snowmaking and snowball. And it's being challenged because it's considered a desecration of sacred properties by traditional religious areas for the tribes in there. Do you see any water rights issues caused from that?
Well, I mean, I think I do because it involves the interpretation of the Religious Freedom Restoration Act, which was designed to require the federal government to observe respect for all religions, including tribal religions, when they're permitting an activity. And so, you know, that case, if successful down there, might affect things like hydropower relicensing. Professor Rogers' daughter just argued a case in the Ninth Circuit last week on behalf of the Snoqualmie tribe, arguing that the FERC license should be remanded to, should be changed to provide sufficient water flows to accommodate the mists that are required by the tribe to conform to its religious beliefs regarding its sacred site of the falls, which is their where they originated. And so the statute, the Religious Freedom Restoration Act, is very important, and water is sacred to many tribes, and it could have a significant effect.
How do the Yakima tribe's water rights being handled in the adjudication within the Yakima Basin, and what lessons do you see from that for the Puget Sound area cases?
Well, the Washington Supreme Court recognized the existence of tribal in-stream flow rights in Aquavella for the Yakima Nation. They found that those rights had been diminished somewhat because the tribe had received payment in the past for damages to their fishery out of the Old Indian Claims Commission. They're the only tribe in Washington that I know of that was paid something for those sorts of losses. So although their rights were diminished, they're still significant, and I think that's an important precedent that argues in favor of recognition of in-stream flow rights for Western Washington tribes. It's the same treaty language, so you know, it's a strong precedent in the state court system. Okay. Anything else? All right. Thank you.